At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batzer, spending time with Josh Hammer, my colleague. His new book is Israel and Civilization, Treblinka. You visited Treblinka, and before we get to the site of the massacre in 23, I've not been to Treblinka. What is it like? What is the experience like visiting? What does it look like today? What's left of it, Josh?
So there's not much left. There's really not much left at all, actually. In fact, so Treblinka is northeast of Warsaw. It's toward Lithuania. So when the Eastern Front for the Nazis started to collapse and the Soviets started making their march on Berlin, roughly around the time that the Western Front started to move from Normandy ever closer to Germany as well, at that point, the Nazis actually tried very hard to hide their war crimes. They essentially tore down all the infrastructure. So there's actually, it's not like Auschwitz. There's no actual physical gas chambers or anything of the sort left. Rather, there was a very crude memorial that's over the entire field, a very large memorial that was actually built by the communists, by the Soviets, when they occupied Poland back in the 60s, 70s, sometime around then. But there are still stones where the train came from Warsaw, the train of death from Warsaw, because most of the Jews of the Warsaw ghetto were exterminated at Treblinka. It was the closest death camp to Warsaw there. But, you know, more generally, John, that was my first and I suppose thus far only experience going to the site of one of these concentration camps there. And we started the day in the Warsaw ghetto. We went to Treblinka afterwards. The thing about Treblinka is it's a really, really, really tiny town. It's absolutely tiny there. And, you know, driving there off the highway, going through these houses, you know, your heart just sinks to the bottom of the earth because you find yourself just asking this question over and over and over again, which is, you know, the folks here knew what was happening. I mean, they could smell it, probably the actual dead bodies. They could feel it. They were not naive to what was happening there. So it's just kind of the classic question is, how? I mean, how did this actually happen? I remember on the drive back to Warsaw, that was the question that I just simply could not spend a second without thinking about.
And now we go to Kfar Azov. What is that and what did you find there?
So this was my January 2024 trip to Israel. I went with a small delegation. We went to a number of the towns that were struck by Hamas in the horrific October 7, 2023 massacre. Kfar Aza is a kibbutz, so it's a small communal settlement, I guess, for lack of a better description. It's actually literally, John, it is on the Gaza border. The western boundary of Kfar Aza, this kibbutz, literally is the wired fence, actually. And this kibbutz was just utterly, completely slaughtered. It was a genuine massacre there on October 7, 2023. It's worth noting, by the way, that the people who populate these Gaza-adjacent kibbutzim, these kibbutzes like Kfar Aza, are typically not right-wing nationalists, the kind of Jews who live in Judea and Samaria. These are actually very left-wing peacenik types. In fact, they were there trying to demonstrate to the Palestinian Arabs and the broader world alike that peace was possible, however naive or foolish that may have been. But you go there, and what can you say? It's like a hurricane struck. I mean, you see kitchen utensils strewn all throughout the streets, children's toys. I mean, the homes look like that an F5 tornado just ripped through there. You walk into some of these homes, and the IDF had marked these homes and say, with a photo, this person was murdered here. This person was taken hostage from here. And I remember walking into one home that the family had opened. This couple was murdered, and the family allowed folks like me to come in there and see it. And they actually put on the wall the last WhatsApp text conversation between this man and wife before they were brutally butchered. And it's unspeakable stuff. I immediately thought of my experience at Treblinka. But the story, in a weird way, has a quasi-happy ending, because I remember with my heart just sinking all the way again to the center of the earth. And this, I'm as melancholy as I've been in my entire life. I remember at that time I started to hear some guitars stringing. And you walk a little further, and I saw two Haredi men, you know, the media would say ultra-Orthodox men, very religious Jews, smiling ear to ear and strumming on their guitars and singing songs there. And the day that I was visiting Kfar Aza, there were a lot of IDF soldiers also there, because the soldiers have to know what they're being asked to fight for in Gaza. Yeah. And we all kind of make a way towards these two Haredi Jews playing the guitar. And we kind of form an impromptu circle, and we're swaying back and forth and singing, and everyone's crying. It was just an extremely powerful emotional experience. And really, I was thinking a lot that day about the refrain that the Jewish people have been saying for many thousands of years: "I'm Yisrael Chai." The Jewish people live through it all. We really do live.
And now we've seen two examples of the complete absence of civilization: one in Poland, another in the border of Gaza. And we're seeing it through your eyes, Joshua. Did your experience so far with being Orthodox, with keeping kosher, with following very carefully the rubrics of the rabbis, did that help you through witnessing what you did? Was it a helpmate?
Look, I think that anyone who has a sense of purpose and meaning, anyone who can answer anyone who thinks that he has an answer, let me say, anyone who thinks that he has an answer to the great questions in life: is there a God? Is he a just, merciful, and loving God? Why do bad things happen to good people? The ever nagging question of theodicy. You know, all great religions, Judaism, Christianity, we all have our answers to the question of theodicy. Judaism certainly does. So when you have answers to these questions, however unsatisfying it sometimes is, these answers do exist. It's absolutely something to fall back on. It is absolutely something to take solace in there, to know that there actually is a broader plan here. You know, traditional Jewish thought would say that Hashem, that God sees it all. He is the creator of the universe. He has a plan for everyone there. Every individual soul has a role to play in this divine plan. You know, we puny little humans might not see it there, but you know, there's a concept in traditional Jewish thought called bitachon, which basically means trust, to trust in this purpose. And if you really come to actually agree with that, and you internalize it, and you truly believe it there, then yes, it helps tremendously.
It's time for the golden rule. What is that, Joshua?
Well, John, the golden rule, as I learned it in my public school kindergarten class in Westchester County, and I think as it's typically taught, is to do unto others as you would like done to yourself, to treat others as you would like to be treated, as the typical formulation goes. But perhaps because I grew up in a public school setting there, and you know, we have this dubious notion of so-called separation of church and state, which means that they're not going to invoke biblical teachings in public school, you know, I wasn't really told, like, what is the origin of the golden rule? And in the book, I argue that the origin of the golden rule is Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, this famous injunction to treat the stranger as your own fellow. That is the direct antecedent of the golden rule. And the golden rule is as important a societal norm as it gets for holding civil society together. It's one of the things that really kind of inculcates the interdependent mutual bonds of loyalty that make a society, that make a nation in the first place there. And it's one of many examples, John, that we can directly trace one of our current societal, social, political, or legal norms to the Hebrew Bible, which is definitely one of the goals of my book, is to kind of draw out these examples anew for a new generation.
We've got 30 seconds. Who's the rabbi who stands on one leg and gives the whole lesson? Who was that?
That was Rabbi Hillel. He was trying to one-up his interlocutor, Rabbi Shammai. Rabbi Hillel famously goes on one foot, and he says to the curious Gentile who is potentially interested in converting that the whole Torah is treat others as you'd like to be treated. The rest is just commentary. Go and learn it. Famous, famous line in the Talmud.
And he does it on one leg. The book is Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. Josh Hammer is the author.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.